I have it, or I have a study.
Good afternoon. I will call the meeting of the Workforce Shortage Working Group to order. We have a pretty tight agenda before us today. We're going to have an opportunity to hear from DEED, and we're also going to have an opportunity to hear from the Department of Health. As Representative Liebling and I were talking since we last met, and further thinking about our charge, it has become more apparent that much of the work surrounding workforce shortage, there has been a lot of study done in Minnesota. A lot of this has been done, and I think perhaps as much as anything, our charge is largely about pulling those various pieces together, and in some cases pulling pieces off the shelf. That represents good work that was done, but as is often the case, we complete the work and then we file the report, and it's the implementation or the action part that sometimes gets misplaced. And so with that, we'd like to begin today by inviting Rachel Vilsack from DEED to come forward and present and talk to us a little bit about a report that they recently completed in June. Ms. Vilsack, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. The report, an overview of the healthcare industry in Minnesota, which you have copies of, was prepared at the request of the Minnesota Hospitals Association in June of this year and authored by me. The report summarizes current labor market statistics in the healthcare industry, including hiring trends, job openings, and projected employment growth. Data in the report largely come from the Labor Market Information Office at the Department of Employment and Economic Development. I'd like to take a few minutes at this time to summarize the key points. The healthcare industry, comprising three sectors, including ambulatory healthcare services, hospitals, and nursing and residential care facilities, is a major employer in Minnesota with more than 344,000 public and private sector jobs, representing 13.4% of total employment in the state in 2009. The industry also drives job creation, with more than 60 additional jobs created in the state's economy for every 100 direct healthcare service positions. Total wages paid to healthcare industry workers topped $16.3 billion, or 14% of total wages paid in Minnesota in 2009. The healthcare industry is second only to manufacturing in terms of total employment in Minnesota. By region, the largest concentrations of healthcare industry employment is in southeast Minnesota, where almost 24% of total regional employment is in the healthcare industry, led, of course, in part by the world-renowned Mayo Clinic. Compared to the nation, Minnesota ranks 10th in 2009, with just under 10% of the total workforce employed in healthcare-related occupations. Employment in the healthcare industry has increased even during the economic recessions of this past decade. Between 2000 and 2009, the healthcare industry added approximately 74,000 jobs in Minnesota. That's an increase of 27%. During the same time period, total jobs in the state fell by 1.5%. More recently, during the 2007 to 2009 recession, the number of jobs in healthcare increased by 4%, with growth in virtually all healthcare industry sectors and led by growth in residential care facilities, home healthcare services, community care facilities for the elderly, and medical and diagnostic laboratories. Reflective in these growth statistics is the trend towards an aging population and increased demand for health services, particularly for elder care. Since March of this year, Minnesota has added 9,500 net jobs in the healthcare and social assistance sector. It should be noted that layoffs in healthcare do and have occurred despite net job growth. During August 2010, There were 2,240 initial claims for unemployment insurance filed from individuals previously employed in the healthcare and social assistance industry. This represents about 9% of total initial claims filed in August statewide. In general, initial claims for unemployment insurance have been on the decline for most industry sectors. Initial claims in healthcare have dropped 4% when compared to 1 year prior in August 2009. With layoffs in the healthcare industry, it is clear that this sector has not been immune to the recession, and recent newspaper headlines have also remarked on some regional healthcare facilities with plans to reduce their workforce. Despite this, job opportunities in healthcare remain good relative to other industry sectors. With approximately 8,400 job vacancies during second quarter 2010, the healthcare industry, including social assistance, had the largest numbers of job openings among industries in the state, representing 1 in 5 job openings. Large numbers of job vacancies were found for home health aides, nursing aides, registered nurses, and LPNs. Approximately half of all job openings in the industry require some form of post-secondary training. And keep in mind that job openings in the healthcare industry include everything from direct patient care professionals, office and administrative support, finance, management, and information technology occupations. Additionally, 1 in 3 job openings in healthcare also require related work experience. With the onset of the recession in 2007, workforce shortages in healthcare professions have lessened. We record 30% more job openings in healthcare in second quarter 2007 prior to the recession than we did in second quarter of 2010. And over the past 10 years that the Labor Market Information Office has analyzed job vacancy statistics, healthcare witnessed its largest number of job openings during fourth quarter of 2001, with more than 21,000 job openings statewide. Despite the decline in healthcare job vacancies over recent years, it remains among the top areas for job opportunities. Healthcare occupations such as registered nurses, nursing aides, and home health aides are listed among the top occupations in demand in all regions of Minnesota. These occupations in demand lists are a semi-annual analysis of the best job opportunities based on regional supplies of and demands for labor compiled for job seekers and dislocated workers by our office. This summer, the Labor Market Information Office released our 2009 to 2019 long-term employment projections for occupations and industries in Minnesota. Job growth in the healthcare industry, including the social assistance sector, is projected to expand by 26% between 2009 and 2019, resulting in the creation of about 103,000 new jobs in the industry. In addition, many more jobs will be open due to replacement hiring as workers retire or otherwise leave their occupation. Between 2009 and 2019, registered nurses, home health aides, LPNs, nursing aides, and pharmacy technicians will require the greatest number of new workers. The fastest growing healthcare occupations in Minnesota include physician assistants, projected to grow 44%, and home health aides, projected to grow 42%. The aging population has implications for the healthcare industry in Minnesota. Population statistics reveal that 16 counties in Minnesota have more than 20% of their population age 65 or over in 2005. In 2010, approximately 16% of Minnesota's population is projected to be 65 years of age and older. That number will increase to 20% by 2020 and projected to reach 26% by 2030. The demand for healthcare services will only increase as our population ages. Likewise, the healthcare industry will also face its own issues around replacing workers who retire and finding employees with the right skill sets. Finally, one issue not accounted for in the most recent state and national employment projections that should be noted is how the health care bill signed into law earlier this year will impact future employment trends in the health care industry. national and state models for employment projections preceded the signing of the bill. It is not known to what extent this may impact employment specifically at the occupational level. It's a very quick overview of the report. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Vilsack. Questions or comments from members? Senator Tomasoni.
Madam Chair, you know, we keep hearing this, that there's a shortage of RNs. And we've been hearing this now for, I would say, 5 or 6 or 7 years. And, in fact, we've actually gone to the point where we've geared up our colleges to make more courses available for RNs so that we can fill the jobs. And yet I get phone calls probably once every 6 or 7 months. Our whole class graduated and not one of us can find a job. And so I'm wondering why we keep saying there's these shortages of people can't find jobs. I mean, is this an old report or is this... What's the real situation? I don't know. Maybe somebody on the panel knows the answer to that question. But I'm very discouraged by the fact that we told a real lot of people they should go get educated as an RN and they can't find a job. So I mean I'm just wondering if there are openings or if there aren't openings. I don't know who can answer it. I don't know.
Ms. Slattengren.
Practical experiences. This summer there were layoffs, and there were nurses who were out, maybe graduating in 2008, couldn't find jobs anywhere within at least metro and even reaching out statewide. I've talked with nurses who are looking to find employment in Texas, wherever they could, just because what was being posted required a year's worth of experience. When you have layoffs and then the industry has clamped down on hiring, you don't get that year's worth of experience as a new grad. So then you have classes that can't get employed. Right now, though, it's starting to open up. We've had historically cycles years ago, and that was a long time ago when I came out, couldn't find a job, but it's cyclically turned over. But the overall view, I believe, we're looking at a huge nursing shortage as nurses retire. Depending on the work environment, if nurses stay in the acute care setting at least, and nursing homes would even be harder to attract too. So I would say don't assume that there isn't going to be a shortage.
Ms. Chesney.
Our students from the University of Minnesota, I know, have experienced the situation where it's difficult to find an acute care job within a hospital setting right now for the very reasons that Linda commented on. But we are finding that our students can go elsewhere. There are shortages elsewhere in the country right now. And we also believe that the shortages that, or the lack of job openings in the metro area that we have seen, and somewhat in the Rochester area, have a lot to do with people's inability to access insurance with the downturn in the economy. A lot of people putting various procedures on hold, elective surgeries that they can wait for, or people not accessing care, clinics not hiring because they're not getting access because of people lacking either insurance or some means of paying for procedures. So I think we very much believe in looking at the projections, looking at the aging population. We believe that, A, there is a shortage right now, although one has to go out into the outer state areas to find jobs. I think more of the jobs are in long-term care right now for our students who are graduating in Minnesota. But we most definitely have shortages across the United States in various pockets right now. And as insurance and access to care changes, I believe, with health care reform, it's very likely that we're going to see people going back and accessing care.
You know, Madam Chair, to that
Senator
point,
Thompson.
Ms. Chesney, I was at one of our community colleges and asked the same question. And I was told, oh, yes, there's openings in our nursing homes for RNs. And I said, how many? And she could tell me about one. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that, you know, we do a real lot of generalizing over some kind of anecdotal stuff that isn't very accurate, not only very accurate, but also very insignificant. And so are these nurses actually going to retire during the recession and during the bad times, and whether or not their 401ks are have gone in the tank and don't have anything? I mean, are they really going to retire, or are we just hoping they do?
Ms. Chesney.
That certainly has been an issue, Senator Tomasoni.
Sony.
We know that.
Rhymes with the Japanese TV, Sony.
Sorry. But we know. know that there were nurses projecting to retire who opted not to for the very reason that you cite with the whole 401k, the economic downturn. But nonetheless, I think that if one looks, you know, we have students that places like Nevada, California, states in the South, that our students could definitely go places and find jobs in places where they have significant shortages right now. But I do think that we're going to see a change, and we are hearing that there are openings across the micropolitan areas and more rural areas in terms of home health and in terms of long-term care facilities. But I don't have a statistic.
But Madam Chair, are these people going to school to become RNs so they can go to Texas, or are they expecting to get jobs in Minnesota? And that's, I mean, because I would think that they should have that information when they go to school, that you might not be able to find a job here in Minnesota, but if you like Texas, we can get you. We can get. I mean, what are they doing? I mean, I think that's. I mean, I don't know if somebody knows that answer or not, but.
I have two members that are chomping at the bit, so.
I'm going to leave pretty quick here, so you won't have to put up with me any longer.
Ms. Rosenbaum.
I honest to God, this is the honest God truth. I would stay for the whole meeting, but
Senator.
I committed a long time ago to be a judge of a chili contest up in Mount Airy, so I have to be 5 o'clock, and there's 20 different chilies that I'm going to have to taste. So.
We need more need for health care. Okay, Ms. Rosenthal.
I think that is an excellent question, and it's one that we at SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, have been wrestling with, because we've negotiated both tuition reimbursement for our members to go back to school, as well as a training and education fund, and we very much want this money to fund people going to school for positions that they can then either get at Health Partners or at Allina. And we anecdotally within the Allina system have heard that there are 300 nursing assistants who have passed their boards and who are chomping at the bit trying to get RN positions. And we did not anticipate that they were going to go to Texas or go to greater Minnesota unless it was within the Allina system, you know, to actually get these jobs. So I think that right now, with the recession, with the fact that a lot of nurses that we anticipated were going to leave the workforce didn't, is that there's a real mismatch between what's been produced and the actual jobs that are out there. One of the things that we really are trying to work with is new graduates, really, especially at a time when there is high unemployment and not a lot of jobs. Employers can really add a lot of criteria on what it is that they want in order to hire. So a lot of positions require at least a year's worth of experience, and sometimes that experience is actually needed, you know, within, you know, whatever the department is. So we're really working with Jane Foote at Workforce Minnesota and the community and technical college system to try to figure out how to build something that might be like a residency program that could be added on, that would be different than a clinical, but then when somebody came out of a program, they could be hired, and that would count as experience, and then they wouldn't end up going to other parts of the country. But I think that you're spot on, Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you. Mr. Rice.
I think some of it also is a distribution issue as much as it is a shortage, because when I was practicing up in Bedette, Minnesota, way up on the border, we got to the point with the nursing that the only way we really could get nurses was to train up through our own personnel, because it was just impossible to get people to come out. And I hear that and see that in other rural areas. And it's not just nursing. It's a lot of these areas we're projecting shortages. You got to look at the whole state, and you got to look at things. And I agree with you. I think you need to be honest as you're educating where the jobs really are, so people know if they're going into an occupation that's somewhat glutted in the cities but is plenty out and out state, you want to make sure it's clear where the jobs are when they're coming through. But I think a lot of these, there are jobs in out state, notwithstanding the immediate concerns over economies. You know, right now we're in a little bit of a bubble on things,
well,
hopefully.
Madam Chair, the out state issue is definitely an issue, because we hear it all the time about trying to get professional people into our hospitals or our dentists or lawyers, whatever they might be, and that the spouse maybe doesn't want to move there. But I think in this particular issue, we have community colleges all across the state in rural areas where we're educating nurses, and they're coming out of these colleges thinking that they're going to be. I don't think they expect to go to the Twin Cities if they're in Wilmer or if they're in Hibbing or if they're in Roseau. And I'm just wondering if we're just overestimating or exaggerating what's going on here, and these kids are coming out of school without a place to go when they did it on purpose to find a job because they were told there were openings.
Ms. Lattengren. I'm with M&A, and I'll answer one question about retirees. Senior nurses would love to retire because it's a very physical job, and it's a difficult job within the acute care setting. Healthcare is an issue, more so probably than the 401. Many have told me they would retire if they could only, you know, that bridge. If there isn't a healthcare bridge for them to retire, then they're stuck until they can absolutely retire at 65. So once that hits, there will be a balloon of retirement, I believe. The other thing is industry planning and budgeting, and how that works, and it deliberately impacts the hiring and laying off of nurses. So that is a factor which creates 900 openings up in Duluth. I think then you have a level of productivity and savings by not hiring on, but by expecting filling in with overtime, whatever shifts. So when that levels out and that is perceived as more of a excessive cost than a savings, I think we'll see more hiring back, especially in the rural areas. But right now, it's about trying to make ends meet, corporate-wise, industry-wise, and it's kind of a weird balance. But if you can fill in the shifts without hiring another RN, that is right now deemed as more economical.
Representative Liebling.
Yeah, I just, and before we get more comment, because I want to sort of throw something else. My additional question on this, and I'm really glad that Senator Tomasoni started this provocative discussion, but I think there might be a difference between the job openings that Ms. Vilsack was talking about in her report to us and the need for services.
Yes.
Right? I mean, isn't that
Absolutely.
Kind of the something that we're sort of struggling with here all along? And when we talk about incentives, which is part of our charge, you know, how do we get the incentives lined up? And I think I tend to think, well, incentives for getting people to train for these jobs and go to school and all that. But we also need a way to get the jobs where the need is, not just the people to fill them. You know, so you know, there might be a disconnect there. I think that is kind of the problem that we're talking about. Nurses getting laid off. I had the same, you know, we all hear, oh, nurses are getting laid off, and yet we know that people don't have the health care they need. You know, kind of how does that happen? Well, it's because we have this fractured system that has to do with, you know, an employer who, you know, either a nonprofit that has to make its bottom line or a profit-making entity that has to make its bottom line, and how do we get these things to line up? So complicated, so complicated, unnecessarily perhaps. How do we untangle these threads?
Ms. Chesney.
Senator, would it be all right for me to ask our guest a question about the report?
Please do.
Ms.
Bussick.
I'm noticing on the chart, and it's the one that has all the very table 3, page 4, that has all the various things listed out. Am I to assume from that he does not collect data or doesn't present data on advanced practice nursing, or am I missing it somewhere in here? Because I see registered nurses with mental health aides, licensed and practical and nursing aides, and then I don't see anywhere where we list advanced practice, such as nurse practitioners or CRNAs, nurse midwives, or clinical nurse specialists. And is that just not data that is collected, or? Curious.
Mm-hmm.
Ms. Vilsack.
Yes, Madam Chair, to address Ms. Chesney's question, all labor market employment projections for every state in the country use a standard occupational classification system, and it's standard across states so that we can compare what outlooks and wage statistics and employment projections exist. In this case, those type of occupations, as you've noted, fall into those standard classification systems. A few that you mentioned currently do not. Starting this year in 2010, they've made some adjustments to our standard occupations occupational classification system, and we'll be expanding some of our data collection for many healthcare occupations, including some that would fall into the more advanced practice nursing fields.
Ms. Vilsack, on that note, as you're looking at reclassification or additional classifications, I would just like to suggest that Minnesota's leading on in the dental therapy area, and that would be an area that certainly would be pertinent to make an addition on. I have a question with regard to that same table on page 4. About midway down, it's physicians and surgeons, comma, all other. And I was wondering if there was a breakout. I'm assuming not, but it wouldn't. It might be helpful if there were a breakout of primary care physicians, because there is so much energy and interest around that initiative, particularly with regard to the federal health care.
Yes, Madam Chair. We do break down some, kind of doctoral openings in a variety of ways, including family and general practitioners. What you noted, physicians and surgeons, all other is a catch-all category for those that aren't listed separately. I think on the table it does reveal some statistics for family and general practitioners, surgeons, internists, and a few other kind of specialties within the medical doctoral field.
So, Ms. Vilsack, or perhaps someone at the table, so family and general practitioners, that's primary care? I can't see you, sir. Dr. Rice.
That's right. That would be family medicine and probably older trained physicians who are not technically subspecialized. But if you look at that category along with on the next page, internist, comma, general, and pediatricians, comma, general, and then sometimes people will put in obstetricians and gynecologists, so that's become a much more subspecialized. But those are listed there. And I think if you look at child and adult general medicine, really those three categories generally of general internists, general pediatricians, and the family medicine will give you a pretty good idea of primary care.
Thank you, Dr. Rice.
Beard.
Dr. Baird.
Thank you, Senator. Building upon that, and maybe Troy Taubenheim might comment also, but the national data is that about 96% of family physicians go into and stay in primary care, about 8% of internists now, and somewhere around 8 or 10% of pediatricians are in primary care. So we have to be careful, just like for nursing, when we lump them too much. And in general, whether it's nurses, advanced practice nurses, or physicians, people just go where the money is, and the money's not in primary care or prevention or public health. That's where the workforce is needed to deliver the services, but that's not where profitability lies. So people are elsewhere.
And we're back to the incentives.
That's right.
All right. Mr. Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Vilsack, I'm wondering which category people who work in group homes for people with disabilities or day training and habilitation would be? Would it be home health aid, nursing aides, or healthcare support workers? There are many thousands of these workers. Where we would find them?
Good question, Ms. Vilsack.
Madam Chair, to answer Mr. Nelson's question, what is presented here in Table 3 highlights those occupational classifications that directly fall within what we call healthcare practitioners and technical occupations and healthcare support. It may be the case that some of those other occupations that you've indicated in group homes and group facilities fall under other occupational classifications, and it's a question that I can bring back to our office to get more concrete information, and it may be the case that some of those occupations are not fully reflected on this list.
Thank you. I appreciate
that. Ms. Vilsack, I think that would be good follow-up, particularly if there are occupational groups related to the disability community, because certainly that is something that should be incorporated into our discussion. So if you could follow up with the chairs, we'd appreciate that. Okay. Questions further on the report, Ms. Rosenthal.
Ms. Vilsack, I thought that I heard you say that this report and everything in it was predicated on before the passage of health care reform. Is that correct? I mean, all of the projections that are here.
Madam Chair, indeed, a lot of the employment projections, both nationally and for the state of Minnesota, because they occurred in 2008, had to make some assumptions on what our economy would look like going forward, projected out to the year 2018 or 2019. The macro model that they used did not take into account any of those changes within healthcare that occur and may occur due to the healthcare reform bill. And obviously, we in Minnesota and nationally do employment projections for occupations and industries twice a year. So those changes that may exist will not fully be reflected in our numbers, until a few years from now.
Additional questions. Dr. Rice.
Question from Ms. Vilsack, following up on Dr. Baird's question. On these lines, I would interpret when it lists general internists and general pediatricians that's those practicing in the general field, not subspecialized field. Because I think Dr. Baird's point is a good one, is that from a training standpoint, many that train in those areas don't remain in those areas. Are those truly those that are still practicing general? Or what's needed in general?
Ms. Vilsack.
Madam Chair, to address Dr. Rice's question, it may be, in fact, that case, and it's another issue that I can bring back to our office, who handles a lot of our occupational coding, to identify those type of specialties that may or may not be included in those what we call general categories. And I'll be happy to return that information to you.
Dr. Baird.
One final comment. By the way, I've been humbled on every workforce projection I've ever made, so I don't think anybody should feel badly about this. But I used to be in COGME in Washington. We were dead wrong. We said we're going to have a surplus of physicians 15 years ago. I do think that the issue of generalism, though, and projecting it, there is currently a well-understood shortage of generalists in adults, but not for child care. And that's current and projected national data. So providing care for children has been, we were all covered by actually nurse practitioners, RNs, some family docs, and pediatricians, but generally there's currently no shortage, and there's not a projected shortage nationally. For adult care, there's the same kind of shortage we're seeing in our projections. So there's a big difference between children's providers. Actually, nationally, we've done such a good job with prevention and all kinds of other things. Children, frankly, aren't as ill as often as they used to be. When they are, they're very sick, and they're in children's hospital, and those of us who are generalists don't provide very much of that inpatient care at all. So there's a big split between adult providers and children's providers for generalists as a projected issue.
Interesting. Ms. Riggs, I have a handy-duty
just a footnote, that's not the case for dentistry.
Yes,
the Affordable Care Act will, the biggest thing happening in dentistry with the Affordable Care Act is 8 to 10 million more children will have dental coverage. And so we have a huge problem with access, having enough workforce for kids nationally.
Thank you for that comment. The questions on the report. Ms. Vilsack, thank you for joining us today, and we look forward to your continued involvement with our group. I hope that both the University of Minnesota and the Minnesota State College and University System are paying great attention to the material that has been presented, particularly in Table 3, in terms of where our growth areas are. And I think one of the things that I hope in part can come out of this work group, and we talked a little bit about this in the larger Healthcare Access Commission this morning, is I think that we can be a conduit between the health policy area and the Office of Higher Education. And I think that there's been a disconnect there. And so it's my hope that we can bridge that a little bit through the work that we are doing. So if you are here with the university or here with Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, stay tuned. Ms. Vilsack, again, thank you.
Madam Chair, thank you.
The next item on our agenda is an update from the Department of Health on the status of the workforce shortage report recommendations made in January of 2009. I'd like to welcome Karen Well to our work group. Ask her to come forward. As we indicated at our last meeting, we became aware of this report that the Department of Health had relatively recently pulled together, and as is often is the case, legislature directs study is done, recommendations are brought forward, and these recommendations, I thought it would be helpful to have kind of an update on the status of those recommendations, and there might be recommendations contained within this that perhaps have been addressed, if you could tell us that, if there are gaps, and there may be things that we might want to try to push forward as a part of the work that this group does. Ms. Well, thank you for joining us today.
I'm Karen Welly, and I'm the Assistant Director in the Office of Rural Health and here in the Minnesota Department of Health, and also served as lead staff to this 2008 work group, presented a report to the legislature in January of 2009. Bill Myers, who is also from our office and is the lead staff for workforce studies at this time. The health workforce shortage study a legislative charge that we received in the summer of 2008 to study changes necessary in national licensure and regulation to ensure full utilization of advanced practice registered nurses, physician assistants, and other licensed healthcare professionals in the context of the healthcare home and primary care delivery system. As we deliberated on how to approach this very brief charge, yet a very big one, of all of the other licensed health professionals that are very important to primary care, that pharmacists were probably the profession that had the most impact, and that's the three professions that we went forward and looked at were advanced practice nursing, physician assistant, and pharmacy, since they have a rather big role in medication management in primary care. So on that note, we gathered members of the boards and associations and from those three professions and formed a work group and began our study. The study focused on a number of different areas, and first of all, we did some work which you have executive summary, but it actually goes into a bit more detail in the report, which we'd be happy to make available. We went into a review of the primary care workforce for physicians, advanced practice nursing, and pharmacists. Then, with our work, we discussed basically what were the core competencies that we felt were important for the independent practice of primary care, particularly in a healthcare home setting. So we gathered a list of those core competencies, and I think they show up in the executive summary that we have. In light of those core competencies, we then looked at what were the barriers to making that, using each profession to the fullest of their licensure. And if there were barriers that were licensure or regulatory barriers, then what were those and what would our recommendations be? We looked at what other states were doing around licensure and regulation, and there were some national reports that we considered as well. Then we took all of that information and as a group came to consensus on a number of recommendations that we put into the report. And I will go through those. One of the main national reports that we looked at actually was something that was a study that was done by a very esteemed panel of state licensing boards in various states in the areas of medicine, nursing, OT, PT, social work, and pharmacy. Those six areas came together and really looked at what legislatures needed to consider if they were looking at scope of practice adjustments. And I wanted to go through those carefully because they were an important part of the recommendations that were developed. The purpose of regulation is to protect the public and not to advance professional causes. It's to protect the public. The changes in scope of practice are part of our current healthcare system. They have evolved over time and will continue to evolve. So everyone just needs to accept that assumption. That collaboration between healthcare providers should be part of the norm. Practice. Interdisciplinary practice is growing and it should continue. That overlap among professions is necessary. There aren't bright lines between the professions and there shouldn't be. That practice acts should require that the licensees meet the qualifications of experience and education. That's pretty obvious. So the conclusions and recommendations. The conclusions and recommendations that were developed were hammered out through a very careful work group process, and you look confused, and that is because they are not on the back of your, they were omitted from the last page of the executive summary that you have. So I just noted that in the handout. It's in the report, and we can get to that executive summary. I'm going to go through them, though.
Okay. I see on the handout that I have on page 3 and 4, I think the recommendations are listed. I'm guessing that you're going to go through. The first one is physician assistants recommended changes. Ms. Welly, would that be, is that
yes.
The page we're on? So I believe that we do have the recommendations in a packet, in the material that we have.
You do
so
have
can
them
follow
in
along.
The presentation.
Okay. Dr. Rice.
Just to point out, too, the handout you gave last time was essentially those lists, too. So we've been given that. So.
Ms. Welly.
So what I wanted to say was that the recommendations that went forward, really, there were many, many recommendations, as you can imagine, in a process like that. Tried to limit the recommendations to those that were within the scope of enhancing primary care delivery, that they would meet considerations of priority and timing, and that they followed pretty closely that scope of practice assumptions that we just covered. Each of the associations were involved in those final recommendations, and was directly involved in as well. So I'm going to, this is not how they're listed in the report, but I'm going to kind of organize them according to topic a little bit, just for the ease of getting us through these. The first ones are around physician assistants, and one of the recommendations that was made in some national reports that our work group adopted was to eliminate the ratio of physicians to physician assistants, which had been on the books until 2009. So our recommendation was to eliminate that according to some national guidelines. But in Minnesota, the comfort level was such that the ratio was changed to 5, and that's what was put forward and passed in 2009. That was part of a physician assistant licensing act that changed registration to licensure, kind of upping the requirements for PAs. So those two both occurred.
Please continue.
Okay. The second couple of recommendations are around medication management. One of them is targeted to pharmacists, and the other is actually has more to do with scope of practice for advanced practice nurses and PAs. The first was to allow pharmacists. There was a list of practitioners that could prescribe under protocol under the direction of a physician or a licensed practitioner, I should say, and pharmacists were not one of them. And that became a problem in terms of medication management. If a pharmacist needed to, for instance, saw that his patient needed to change the level of their anticoagulant or something, then they couldn't do it. They would have to go back to the physician or to do that. So this allowed them, this change that then was passed and supported by the Board of Pharmacy and the Pharmacists Association made that change, and now that is occurring. And I did have a conversation with the, moving on to the second one, which is allowing advanced practice nurses and physician assistants to enter in this same type of relationship with pharmacists. That really had to do more with, as I said, the independent practice of APRNs and PAs. And in Minnesota, and just, well, everywhere, physician assistants must be under the supervision of a physician. So this recommendation couldn't have gone forward with PAs. The advanced practice nurses had a bill that was introduced, and I will talk about that a little bit more in nursing recommendations, but that would have affected their to independently prescribe, and then they could have probably also done that. What I've been told by the Board of Pharmacy is that to get around this with this change, since pharmacists can now prescribe under protocol, they can also achieve that same kind of second, it can be transferred through a collaborative agreement, prescribing agreement that a physician may have with the PA or a
So, Ms. Welly, would your testimony be that there doesn't need to be any additional work done, even though that measure did not pass because of the changes that were made? Ms. Welly.
What I would say is that the pharmacist relationship was improved, and which licensed practitioners they would work with is another topic. Okay. I just put them together in this thing.
Okay. Thank you. Please continue.
The advanced practice of registered nursing recommendations, as you can imagine, were the most controversial and were hammered out very, very carefully in discussions between representatives of the nursing and medicine groups and the commissioner. And those two recommendations really were meant to go in tandem. Previous to, actually still currently, advanced practice nurses may prescribe only under a written agreement with a physician. And that was identified as actually one of the barriers by the nurses and agreed upon by the group as being a potential barrier for access, especially in rural areas where it was difficult sometimes for APRNs to find a physician that they could enter into an agreement with, and it became sometimes somewhat of an artificial arrangement, not necessarily protecting the patient. So but there was a concern, and so also the current statute, as not changed, required that advanced practice nurses practice in a healthcare system that has a collaborative management arrangement or agreement. That collaborative management really is intended to be collaborative management of a patient's care. But what has ended up happening is that the collaborative management of patient care turned into a collaborative or a confusion or misperception that had to do with managing nurse practitioners or advanced practice nurses. So because of that, there were some institutional and reimbursement decisions sometimes that got mixed up in that confusion. If you read the statute, it's not necessarily that confusing, but people don't always read it that clearly, and so misperceptions were carried. And so there was some problem with that. So the two recommendations that came forward needed to be in tandem because there was a great concern that patients be protected, So eliminating the prescribing agreement would do a lot to sort of accessing care and making it a lot easier to deliver care, especially in underserved and rural areas. However, the recommendation that went forward was to strengthen and make sure that to put the onus on an advanced practice nurse that he or she practice within a health system that has a written plan for patient-centered care, so that referrals, consultation, you know, any time that there's any concern about the ability or scope of a particular nurse practitioner or advanced practice nurse, that there is already an agreement in place with a facility or another provider that would ease that patient's transition. So a good part of any good healthcare system. And so that was the hammered out recommendation. That basically went forward in a bill in 2009. It came in somewhat late and got somewhat delayed and didn't move forward at the end of the session.
Thank you. Dr. Rice.
I sat on this task force, and it wasn't just a matter of late. Unfortunately, after we'd agreed on things, I got into the uncomfortable situation having to testify against that. Because what was agreed upon was this language, and our understanding from the MA and the MAFP, which I had been involved with and worked hard to try and get the agreement with, was that this would be an agreement that would be for all advanced practice nurses in whatever setting. And the bill that went forward was only targeting the independent practice nurse practitioners and advanced practice nurses. And the MMA's feeling was is that sort of agreement was also important to have in place within healthcare systems and other places, not just in an independent practitioner basis. And that was why we had to oppose it, which we felt was very unfortunate, because it was very difficult to kind of work out the agreement, because this has always been a touchy issue between our organizations, and in the end it failed partly because of that.
Ms. Chesney.
Madam Chair, I believe that there were misunderstandings, and I think we didn't have an opportunity to come to some kind of agreement about that. I do want to clarify, Dr. I guess what the intent of the bill from the advanced practice community was in terms of not legislating for nurse practitioners or CRNAs or advanced practice who are already in systems, not legislating to systems to further complicate the situation. So we felt if someone was going to be in an independent or a freestanding clinic or an advanced practice nurse-run clinic, that by all means, as any other health plan would do, you would want your patients to know, if you become really ill, this is where I will be referring you to the hospital. If you need a specialist, this is the system that I work with. That we would have that spelled out. If you are a nurse practitioner right now, or an advanced practice person, and you work within a system such as Allina, you work for the Allina Clinic System or the Fairview Health Systems, those systems already have in place what they do for their patients, whether it's a physician who's seeing the patient or a nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant. They have in place their referral systems. They have in place the hospitals to which they would refer patients in need of admission. And we felt that to add that kind of complexity to that bill and put a further mandate on systems than to say, now, not only do you need, you know, we're operating fine, but now we want you to be sure you have this spelled out once again for all of your specific nurse practitioner or advanced practice people, seem to be a burdensome kind of onus to place on systems. So that was the differentiation between saying we are treating people already in systems, where that's all set up differently, from advanced practice who would attempt to have an independent nurse-run clinic. And so I believe that was the difference of opinion about how to approach that occurred at that time. The second piece is that when we got to the hearing, it really became apparent that what I believe we were hearing, and Dr. Rice can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe we were hearing is that the physicians that the Minnesota Medical Association is asking of us is really to have a written agreement between a physician saying that if my patients need to be seen, would you be willing to see them? And we felt that that would be more onerous and present more barriers than the current law we had would present, and did not feel to us to be the intent that I think the commissioner had in mind, and that was just to be a sound healthcare system that you would allow your patients to access a clinic to know where they're going to go and what their disposition will be.
Dr. Rice, I'm going to let you make one brief comment, but we're not going to entertain the merits of the recommendations in this work group. Dr. Rice, do you have anything you want to quickly add?
I think the MMA would be open to more discussion on it, but I think it is, there is a feeling with MMA that some of the issue with how this plays out is with some of the health systems, because and it is from the standpoint of where do they place and how are they utilizing nurse practitioners within that system, and to what degree are they operating independently or with the collaboration? And I'm not saying that well, but it wasn't just an issue of the independent, and that was expressed at the other meetings, so we felt it was a bit of a jump on that. And I think that, you know, anything that goes forward, we did not feel this language was terribly specific about what was written. It was just that there is some sort of plan that patients, if they are concerned about that, are able to talk with and say, this is who I work with, this is how I would play things out. And did not seem like something that was much beyond what's already in place and would actually be much less restricted than what's currently in place.
Ms. Welly, I would like to continue with the recommendations.
The rest of the recommendations that are listed here, to ensure that in the context of healthcare home, that the healthcare home learning collaboratives would address interprofessional cultural issues, collaboration, and team skill building. And I will report that, of course, the healthcare homes went forward and the learning collaboratives are in operation, and that is certainly part of the learning process. There was a real interest on the part of the work group members that did roll their sleeves up and come to these meetings, that the work that they did would not just melt away, but that there would continue to be, there really was a sincere, I think, hope on everyone's part that interdisciplinary work and between the boards and higher education and the department would continue. And that has continued informally. And I know that the University of Minnesota is particularly advanced in terms of interdisciplinary education. Finally, there were a couple of recommendations because any changes that would occur to any of the Health Professional Practice Acts occur within the Practice Acts. But in Minnesota statutes and regulations, there are many instances and citations where changes are still lurking out there. For instance, Department of Transportation might ask for a physical, and they say a physician in the, the law says a physician. So where an advanced practice nurse or a PA is perfectly capable of doing a physical, but the law still says physician. So there are many of those instances. Really probably hundreds or thousands of cases like that, and it would be quite a intensive effort, and the resources really weren't there to do that, and I don't think the department did anything, and I don't know if anyone else did. And finally, there were issues that were identified in the report that did not make it into the recommendations because they really didn't pertain to Minnesota licensure regulation, but they did affect, they were important considerations, and they were around reimbursements and sometimes federal issues like Medicare regulations and payment. And I just want to report that the Affordable Care Act did make some changes to in terms of allowing physician assistants to order nursing home services and other post-acute services. Nurse practitioners and advanced practice nurses are already able to do that. It increased the concerns on the part of advanced practice nursing was the reimbursements, and they did nurse midwives were able to get full reimbursement under the Affordable Care Act. That's all I know specifically that would pertain to some of the recommendations in the report.
Thank
so that's
Ms.
all I have.
Thank you, Ms. Welly. Ms. Chesney.
Just a point of clarification, Madam Chair, and that is that in the current CMS rules and in the law that changed for PAs that does not affect nurse practitioners, I believe that Representative Allison Schwartz in the Congress is trying to put forward a bill that would also add nurse practitioners to be able to do home health orders and what have you, but currently there are barriers that still exist for advanced practice in the CMS rules and the regs and the bill.
Thank you. Dr. Rice.
Do you know why that is?
Ms. Chesney.
Madam Chair.
Dr. Rice,
I don't. It was just kind of an oddity that came out of the bill, and right now there's great difficulty in finding a vehicle to attach a small piece of, I believe, editing that needs to occur. And I believe at this point Representative Schwartz is receiving considerable pushback from medical FDA and some medical associations who would prefer that PAs do that and not nurse practitioners. And so we're not quite sure why that is, but at this point they're hoping for enough authors and an ability to find something to tack that on to increase that, because that certainly is a very particular, as you can imagine, in your area, neck of the woods, in rural areas, it's very concerning that nurse practitioners caring for these patients cannot refer them to the appropriate services.
Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you. I just, Ms. Welly, I just wanted to comment, first of all, that when I got a chance to really read the report, I was very impressed with the work and with the work of the entire group. And I think it's full of very useful information, very helpful, very practicable. And so I really want to commend you for that. I also want to say that I began to think about that it's a little bit, although it's incredibly useful for our work in the whole area of how are we going to get services provided in the right services in the right place at the right time, at the right cost, hopefully, it's a little bit outside the charge of this particular work group, because if as I go back and read what the Healthcare Access Commission actually asked us to focus on, it's really incentives. The incentives piece. And so I think even though there's, I hope that the legislature, you know, probably we as members of healthcare committees will be taking a lot of looks at, you know, what kinds of regulatory changes need to be made and further ones need to be made and so on. And that's important to us. I don't know, I think it's just these particular issues are a little bit outside the scope of this committee. So I just wanted to make that point. But I really did want to commend you, because I felt the way the report was put together, organized, the stuff it covered was just done in a very useful, helpful way.
Mr. Taubenheim. How'd I do?
Madam Chair, thank you. Question for Ms. Welly on the report, and I don't want to lead any more into this debate, maybe about the, you know, why some of these recommendations were made. As I read this and I focus on the healthcare home model, the primary care focus, it seems like the recommendations are a little bit counterproductive to that, because they focused on independent practice of the nurse practitioners and PAs or the pharmacists, and that it got away from working in a healthcare home perspective. Is that, am I misinterpreting that?
Ms. Welly.
Thank you, Chair. I think that the focus of the work was on the delivery of primary care in a healthcare home setting and using each professional at the highest level that they could contribute to the team. So providing the most flexibility and really access to care. So I think it was really within that context that we to look at licensing and regulation, even though it did seem very focused. It did have a big
ball on it. Okay.
Final comment, Ms. Chesney.
Chair, Representative Liebling, would like to just comment on the piece about incentives and on our charge, and is the incentive to try to encourage, to provide incentives that keep our primary care workforce here and our workforce here. I would like to just suggest we have a number of graduates leaving advanced practice registered nurse programs, and I can assure you that we have a number of people who are readily flowing across our borders to Wisconsin and to Iowa, where advanced practice environment is far more friendly towards APRNs, and that we don't, our colleagues to the east and to the south of us are not dealing with some of the same barriers and some of the same restrictive kinds of rules and regs going on within the institutionally imposed ones as well as statutory. So I would encourage us to look at incentives from a broad perspective and suggest that we want to provide our advanced practice people with incentive to stay in this state. And right now, among our neighbors, we have one of the more restrictive environments for advanced practice. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Because
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I thank you for that. I think that makes a very good point to look at incentives a little bit more broadly. I don't know how much of that we can bite off in this work group because we have such limited time and what seems to be such a big responsibility, even in this little slice. But I think you make a very good point.
Maybe, Ms. Chesney, you would might be helpful if you wanted to or could provide a little bit more detail, particularly as it pertains to the workforce and why in that particular area it's perhaps more attractive in our neighboring states. Mr. Gill, maybe you could provide us some information on what the differences are between, I think you mentioned Wisconsin and Iowa, is related to that occupational field. Because, you know, I would argue that could fall within our charge. If there are things that we can do to keep Minnesotans in Minnesota and gainfully employed, I think that's part of is a win-win and can help to address any shortages that are projected. Ms. Riggs.
Would you entertain a similar thing on the topic of pharmacy? Similar? I have some colleagues at the university I know that would be interested in probably doing a corollary memo about the issue of pharmacy.
So, Ms. Riggs, if I'm understanding your question, you're suggesting could we entertain some comments of how in the area of pharmacy perhaps it's easier to do business in some of our neighboring states.
That broader definition of incentives.
Representative Liebling,
just customers.
I don't know. We haven't really heard about any data in this group yet about sort of a brain drain, if you will, in pharmacy to other states. Maybe we need to sort of start there. If we are actually losing workforce.
No jobs.
I think it's more because we do have health care home legislation and the Accountable Care Organization legislation looming over us. I think it's just, it may be a little bit more proactive thinking than what we're seeing with advanced nurse practitioners in the very short term.
Well, according to the material that Ms. Vilsack gave us in pharmacy, there's projected to be a 15% change in those numbers. I don't think there's any harm in it. If we've got a resource that can pull some things together, I think that would be helpful. We'll take a look at it, and we'll see if there's something there that we can run with. But I think you know, what's good about this discussion is we're kind of getting to this part on the incentives, and we need to think pretty broadly what that looks like, particularly incentives that don't look like money. because we have none. As I know my chair reminded me of just this afternoon once again. So that's great. Ms. Welly, thank you very much. My final comment to you would be I really appreciated kind of the rules of the game that you laid out initially on the scope of practice assumptions. In fact, I think I'm going to save those, and I'm going to use them in every hearing that I am in with regard to licensure and certification and scope of practice, because I think it would behoove us all well to sort of stay focused on really what why it is that we're having the discussion in the first place. So thank you very much. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You just reminded me of something, too, and I wanted to... I wanted to ask about more the group than Ms. Welly in particular. I'm trying to find here the slide that had, here it is, the one that's, it's on page 2, the second one, purpose of regulation, et cetera. And it caught my attention, the purpose of regulation, public protection. Should have top priority in scope of practice decisions rather than professional self-interest. You know, I think it's probably goes without saying that professional self-interest shouldn't be the issue, and I think probably everyone would agree with that. But I wonder about the other part of this, if everyone agrees that the purpose of regulation is public protection. I mean, certainly that's a purpose, but... you know, does anybody care to add anything to that? I mean, are there, you know, does everyone agree the purpose of regulation is public protection, or are there other goals of regulation that we should be, you know, have in mind? Because I mean, this is, you know, are these assumptions ones that everybody actually agrees with?
Ms. Chesney.
Madam Chair, that's an interesting question, because I think, again, it goes to how does one define public protection. It could just simply say we want to make sure that we have safe practitioners out there and someone's not going to get hurt. It was very interesting in a February Board of Nursing meeting in which I attended, and we were talking about a model of advanced practice registered nurse regulation, that in describing some of the issues and some of the barriers, that a public consumer member made the comment that is it not in the best interest of protecting the public safety to ensure that our citizens have adequate access to health care? Mm-hmm. And so in that respect, it generated a fascinating discussion among board members, and I think they came to a consensus that, indeed, it does go beyond does a person practice safely. It also means we have to protect our public to make sure that people who need health care have access to it, and have access to it in a timely fashion so that they can take care of whatever the concern is prior to getting into further problem with their concerns. So I think, again, it's one of those things where one could broaden the perspective of what does protecting the public mean, and I think that might be something we may want to keep in mind.
Dr. Rose.
Madam Chair, I would agree with that. I mean, I think that part of the charge is to make sure there's adequate supply and access, but I don't view that as being inconsistent with public protection. I would take a broad view of that, and I think that really is the purpose of legislation. And I'm not a big regulatory type person personally, and I guess to me, if something isn't ensuring that protection and isn't necessary, it's better for it to be out of the way and not create obstacles. But ultimately, the reason to regulate per se, I think, is public protection, and should be viewed more on that basis.
And Ms. Slatgren.
I would suggest that it addresses accountability. And I think as we start looking at legislating around healthcare reform, that we look at a system that provides quality care and a continuum of care, that and how that would best work and what professions can work at their level, highest level, to do that. In an economy that is so stretched right now that access to care and cost of care, of course, has got to be an issue. I also, in our conversations, there's a real concern that as we start creating healthcare homes, that we that some of the patterns of filling in with care workers that are not licensed and not professional, that we fragment care, it becomes less holistic, and it becomes tasked out to caregivers or care workers that are really not licensed or well regulated. So we have a concern around that we don't just leap to fill in holes with unprofessional or allied workers that really are being asked to do more than they should.
Thank you. Next on our agenda, we are going to hear about an incentive. And this comes to us courtesy of Senator Erickson Ropes, who is a member of this work group. It's my understanding that there's some significant rainfall in southern Minnesota, and while Senator Erickson Ropes regrets that she wasn't able to swim here today.
We're going to swim home.
Yes. But in any event, we're going to hear a little bit about the clinical coordination project. It's my understanding that this is a pilot that is underway. And I'd like to invite Elizabeth Beal, Heather Frolick, and Margot Marco to come forward. I'm not sure if you're all coming together or individually.
Come after I.
Are you Ms. Beal?
Yes, I am.
Ms. Beal, welcome to the work group.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What I would do is just go over the bare bones of the project, and then after the PowerPoint, I'll invite Heather Frolick, and Margot Marco, and Tanya Valachik with Fairview to come up and give their perspective on being involved with the project. I've been involved with clinical coordination efforts for about 10 years. In 2000, I worked with the Minnesota Hospital Association as their staff for the development committees, and that's when clinical coordination first came to light. About 2005, I moved to work with Minnesota State Colleges and Universities with Health Force, and again, clinical coordination issues fell on my lap. And that's really when we started pilots to actively look towards doing something about them. In 2005, we started pilots in Minnesota, two of them, one was in the Winona La Crosse area, and the other was in Alliance Systems, and with about 9 education programs throughout the metro area. At that time, we looked at other states that had also been having clinical coordination issues, namely Arizona and Oregon. At the time, we really liked the Oregon model, and we purchased their software to bring to Minnesota to see if we could bring similar benefits here. For the first 2 years, we struggled a bit. As we know, you can't just up and bring a state here, so we really had to figure out how to make it work for Minnesota. And at first, when we really were looking at this issue, we were looking at increasing capacity. Because as we all hear, there's not enough clinical sites, so it seems pretty straightforward. Let's just increase capacity. Well, when we were having that as our target, we struggled. Then we took a step back, and we really looked at what are the effects on our capacity. And when we looked at that, we realized that a lot of the effects that affect our capacity today deal with either efficiencies or utilization. And because of these two variables, decreased capacity is somewhat of a byproduct. So then we shifted our strategy to really target increasing efficiencies and increasing utilization, and what we found is much easier to meet capacity needs. So that's really when we started, when we got up to our legs, is when we realized that perspective. This slide, so why is it inefficient and underutilized? It's not because anyone's trying to create this byproduct. It's mainly because this is how it's always been done. But this is how we've always been done. It worked. There's a reason why it was created. But today we're bigger than we've ever been before. We're more complex than we've ever been before. And plus, we're continually asked to do more with less. And therefore, with those three barriers, what we've always done doesn't always work. This slide is the best illustration I've found of what the current clinical activity is like. When I present this slide to those that do clinicals, a lot of them nod their head. Basically, what I want to show is that everybody's going in the same direction. They're trying to schedule clinicals. They're trying to either schedule them or secure clinicals. But it's all disconnected. Everyone's in the dark. There's a lot of silos. Nobody knows the entire picture. and everything's done independently and independently and differently among all the partners. There's a lot of task redundancy, and there's a lot of fragmented information, which really kind of leads to a very highly chaotic and frantic environment. Now, when I speak about independently and differently, the first thing I want to speak of is data. This happens to be an example of a clinical partner and how they collect their data. It happens to be in Excel, and this is about, I'd say, about 8 pages long. Likewise, this is an education partner. And again, many pages long, this happens to be in a Word document and a table. I've seen these in multiple different formats, handwritten, on calendars, in Excel, and in Word. But one thing that's the same among them all is they're all different. So what I mean for nursing, I don't have hard numbers, but this is a pretty strong projection. There's at least 65 different methods of doing this just for nursing. And they're not bad. Each one of these isn't bad, but can you see how they don't talk to each other? And can you see how if this education program made a request to this clinical partner that there'd be some translation that have to take place, and likewise, any feedback from this to this database, there would also need to be some translation. Along with the data is everyone utilizes how they plan with their data differently. This slide shows that how everybody's doing the same thing, scheduling clinicals, but they're doing it at different times. A good-sized hospital will probably have relationships with 5 to 10 education programs. And if they're all contacting the hospital at different times for space, you can see how that could be a chaotic environment. Likewise, a good-sized education program, they're probably working with 5 to 10 clinical sites. And if they're hearing back from clinical sites all at different times, it can be highly confusing. Those are the main issues we found. So what have we done to address this? We've really come together to try to increase efficiencies and utilization through committed partnerships, sustained communication, data standardization and transparency, and technology. How we do it? The partners that I work with today, they say that the number one thing that we do is we bring them together, not just one hospital and their education programs. I mean all clinical sites in an area with all the education programs so that we can identify what the real-time issues are and work together to solve them collaboratively. We try to bring a neutral environment in which all issues that are raised or implemented are developed by the partners, both education and clinical, for the partners. We also commit to increase the efficiency through utilization. Basically, what we try to do is build the trust. Let me take a step back. Currently, the clinical environment can be so tight that sometimes if an education partner doesn't need space, they're going to hold on to that space because they're afraid they're going to lose it. But if we all work together, we can say, you can say that you're not going to utilize it this semester so that another school can. We'll make sure that you have first dibs, basically, for it next semester. And that's really helped not only with efficiencies but the utilization. In terms of the data, we really work to try to clarify and simplify the process so it's as simple as possible. If we recall those two data examples, this is a screenshot of our live database that's online. It's apples to apples with what education programs are using that are involved in the project and also what clinical sites are using. So what happens is this data becomes live. It's sitting in one area, and clinical sites can go to it, communicate their changes, and instantaneously, clinical sites will know exactly what the requests were. Likewise, clinical sites can go to this site, put their decisions in or requests for additional information, and instantaneously, the education program knows this. This information is sortable, and it's also helpful in determining capacity needs or what's currently used today. Now, if you recall how we use the data together, this slide kind of shows how everybody comes together on the same timeline so that everybody knows who's doing what, and also we all commit to having things submitted at the same time. This slide is the same as this slide, same steps, but I like this one better because I think it shows how it's a process, how we all come together, we plan what we're going to do for that planning period, be it either for a semester or for a whole academic year, that we go through the process, and then we meet to see what worked, what didn't work, and always to improve what didn't work for the next scheduling process. Now, That's just a broad overview of what we've done to address this issue. For the first time, we were able to evaluate our pilot, and this means that we were able to look at a period of activity for a year before the pilot, and then we went through a pilot period, and then we looked at a period of activity after the pilot period was done with 9 hospitals and 9 education programs. Hospitals were all large, small, and medium, and the education programs were the U of M, there was St. Kate's Bethel, and 5 education programs. I mean, 5 Minsky programs, both 2-year and 4-year. So first we asked them what they thought of the pilot, and as you can see, 100% felt that the partnership was important, and also 100% of the pilot felt it was valuable to their clinical coordination work. They also 100% felt that the sustained communication was important. Now, the data standardization and transparency and technology, these results were released in March. We've already implemented efforts in place to help improve those numbers. Another nice thing is suddenly we have a very large picture of what the clinical activity is that we never had before. And now we can kind of really look at where is the clinical activity? What do most schools utilize for clinical activity? This is helpful for planning, and also I've just recently started working with clinical sites that, potential clinical sites, those that haven't didn't think they could be a clinical site before. Can I give them information of maybe where they could provide clinical sites? Also, we could cut the data up to make a look to look at what days of the week when most activity is, and this is helpful for curriculum planning. Also released in March were partner savings. For clinical partners, they reported that before the pilot, they were spending about 60 minutes per clinical activity, and after the pilot, we were able to whittle that time down about 15 minutes per scheduling clinical activity.
Ms. Beal?
Yes.
You had a pie chart just a few slides ago. Can I ask you to go back there? Can you? It's hard for us, I think, to see that chart.
The most experiences are provided in med-surg areas. The second largest would be critical care and OB. And then we have psych, and there's rehab, and so forth. But the top 3 are OB, critical care, and med-surg, and then close behind that is psych. And this is, I should note, this is for registered nursing, baccalaureate, 2-year.
Thank you.
Now, education partner savings. When in the pilot, a clinical partner enters with all their education partners. An education partner doesn't enter in necessarily that way, so what that means is the U of M, working with Illini in the clinical coordination project, they still might have another clinical site that isn't in the program. But most education programs do see how this could benefit if all their clinical sites were involved in the pilot. Since we've come out with this in March, we've grown. We've currently, before we, it was Illini and Winona La Crosse area. Since March, we've grown to include Fairview, Children's, Emmanuel St. Joseph's from Mankato, and also yesterday I've just started working with Health East. So we've grown significantly. With that, I'd like to invite my partners up. There's Heather Froelich with Illini, Margo Marco, and she's with the School of Nursing at the U of M. Both have been with the pilot for about 4 years. We also have Tana Valencia, and she's with Fairview, who is a new user. And I thought I'd just let them give their perspective of being involved with the project.
Ms. Beal, before we do that, a question, and maybe you covered this and I missed it, but how did this get started?
It's kind of interesting. It was started through grant funds. We've been funded through a variety of streams throughout the years. It started from grant funds from, I believe, HRSA. And then it was invested, and then throughout time it's been invested through Minsky investment funds. Currently we're being funded through part of a Department of Labor grant, two Department of Labor grants, some Health Force funds, which is an entity that also provides grant funding through Minsky. So it's kind of multiple places that this has been started.
Ms. Riggs.
And on your slide, just so I'm kind of caught up on a couple of terms you used, you had a chart that said D and E. I had no idea what D and E meant.
Oh, day and evening.
And you had a
an acronym of CC in the chart before that, and I didn't know what that meant.
Sorry, clinical Ms. coordination.
Thank you.
And Ms. Beal, on the back of this handout, is that an exclusive list or all-inclusive list of the currently the providers and the educational programs that are involved in this? Do you still call it a pilot, Ms. Beal?
Well, the lineup portion, I think they're out of their pilot stage, but we just started working with Fairview. HealthEase isn't included in this because I just met with them yesterday. So they go through a pilot period before they really get up and running to the project. So we still have some pilots, but we also have an established partnership going on, too.
Ms. Riggs.
And someone's here from the School of Nursing, but who else at the University of Minnesota are you working with at, in terms of the educational partnership, particularly the medical residents?
Well, first, we're just began working with their laboratory program. And also in areas of growth have been small rural providers in the Pine City area. We also received interest from 3 long-term care pilots. 2 are in Alexandria. 1 will be Ebenezer in the metro area. Also, we've began looking at how we can utilize this for advanced practice nursing, CNAs. Right now, most of the data we had is registered nursing because we wanted to start with what we thought was the most complex at the time. But we've already received a lot of interest from allied health and also advanced practice to see how we can bring similar benefits to those arenas.
I've been working with Liz Beal as well, and we're in our pilot phase. We're starting with nursing because this was designed for nursing, pre-licensure nursing, so we entered in thousands and thousands of records so far. But at Fairview, we're really partnering with Liz, and we have pressured to use this tool for medical students as well. We want to work with her to develop that. As she mentioned, advanced practice. We already have something going on with lab or Alina does that we want to model. And just yesterday, our rehab department, which is physical therapy and OT, and that want to use it too. So I would see after we get a lot of those records in, there is really a driving force to have more of the professions in here.
Thank you.
And what Liz didn't bring up yet is this is a great retention tool because in our system, we had everything on pieces of paper, and all of them looked different. And we have, I think it was 185,000 hours tracked, not to count the hours that haven't been tracked. And so if one person left, we had one person doing this that worked there 40 years. It's just we need to have people that have a place to store the data to look at it objectively, and this provides that as well.
Thank you. Welcome to the work group. I will ask that you each introduce yourself at your designated presentation. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Heather Frelick. I'm representing Alina Hospitals and Clinics. And as you know, Alina is a very large healthcare system. We're comprised of 11 hospitals and over 80 clinics. And we have more than 2,000 nursing students having clinical experiences each academic year at our hospital sites. So a very large number, and until we partnered with Liz on the Student Max and the Clinical Coordination Project, each hospital, as Laura said, did this coordination themselves their own way. We could never compare the data. We could never look globally at it and try to make decisions or trends, that sort of thing. Now we have one database, so we're much more efficient, and we can generate some really useful reports. We can review the data, we can determine trends, and we can strategically plan for future experience in areas that we previously underutilized or maybe didn't utilize at all. So that's been really helpful. Clinical space is really identifiable right on the database for our partners as well as all the clinical sites, and we can be more creative about the traditional nursing clinical experience. Just think, are there different ways that we can do this to enhance the nursing education? And Liz had mentioned one of our biggest benefits, not just using this StudentMax tool and having improved clinical coordination, but the partnership and collegiality that's come out of it, where we have hospital sites and schools meeting together in one room for the first time. We used to keep these meetings very closed, and we didn't invite other partners. We didn't want to know what other people were doing. But now we're in one room together planning how can we improve nursing education to meet the needs of our patients and communities in this growing healthcare change. So thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. My name is Margo Marco. I'm with the University of Minnesota School of Nursing. And I had the privilege to be part of this pilot when I was invited. I said yes right away. I've been working on clinical placements for the School of Nursing for the last 11 years. And do that for all of our pre-licensure students, and I also participate with our faculty in finding placements for our advanced practice students across all of our programs. And so the opportunity to look at a way that we could come with Alina and sit down at a table and explore how we could use a tool, which really is what this has been, that would replace what I would have to do either way. I jokingly said I could send it in Excel, I could put it on a carrier pigeon, I could do whatever we needed to get my request through. But what a nice opportunity to do it in a standardized way where we, when we sat around the table, we talked about the language we use. And we know that among our different professions, we use different language. Even within our own profession, within our own hospital systems, we use different language. So it allowed us to do some standardization with that. And it allowed us to talk about what our needs really were and how we would request those and how we would use them. And we really did operate in a mode where sometimes we would hold on to something for lack of being worried that we would lose it otherwise. So this really put our cards on the table. We talked about how best to work requests with our students in order to meet our course objectives. And we had all the other schools at our side. I know St. Kate's regrets that they couldn't be here today, but they hands down said that it's been a great opportunity for them to work together also. One of the other things I wanted to say, and you actually already saw it happen, is when Laura talked real quickly and said, well, Alina's trying something with the lab, and we're going to jump on that and use that idea. This is unprecedented to have this kind of conversation going on amongst our education partners and our health system partners and saying we're not going to recreate it and put necessarily our stamp on it. We're going to see that this has really worked in another system. Let's model that here and try it on in our system. So it's been really refreshing, and it's been really great.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you.
I'm Tanya Blishek, and I'm with
Fairview.
And one of the big things with the clinical coordination project, I'd like to reiterate that communication and working with the other partners and collaborating with them in order to get students placed and have a more efficient and effective way for the students to come and have clinicals is very important. We're starting with nursing and then eventually moving on to the other types of clinical rotation, which I find very exciting because it's a place for the students to come and know exactly, okay, I'm going to have my clinical or my rotation here and not have to go through all the different channels. So it will be very efficient and effective. And so I'm really excited about our pilot at Fairview and working with the rest of the team.
Ms. Slattengren.
Madam Chair, as a newly retired Alina employee working on MedSurg ortho-neuro, I hope, and I think this is great because I think the clinical, a clearinghouse for clinical scheduling is awesome for the students and for the schools. How that filters down onto the units, because I can tell you that students just appear, and how that clinical load on the units needs to be evaluated, and how you can implement a quality clinical experience within the units as it flexes and nurses are being moved around, how that can be accomplished. I mean, I think there needs to be a dialogue on that, because the pushback will be nurses won't be willing to do the clinical experience with your students, and I would be very saddened. But I think that that is an inherent problem on the units.
That's one thing that we try to address when we're all together. I mean, clinical partners come and share that our units get discouraged when students don't show up. So as we work at the partnership, that was laid on the table initially. Mm-hmm. And now also we have in place strategies to let us know if you're not going to use that clinical by as soon as you can so that we can inform our units and that way maintain or improve the relationships between the education partner and the units.
I'm looking inversely at students just appearing and the nurses aren't aware of it. So how that can be tightened up and really make a real clinical program out of it would be really beneficial.
Ms. Froelich.
If I can address that. Mm-hmm. One of the features of the program is a calendar type of database where we could have our managers of a particular unit download which students are coming to their unit on a particular date and time. Mm-hmm. It's all on a beautiful calendar. They can pull it out at any time. They don't need a password or special training in order to use this system. The academic coordinator at the site can just tell them, you just click here, open up your calendar for the dates you want, a whole month, a whole year, a semester, whatever, and they can see which students are coming from which schools, on which days, how many hours, et cetera. So it's a wonderful communication tool for the unit.
Right, and I would suggest that it should drive adequate staffing to address them, okay. Which it doesn't right now.
Mr. Tobinek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what I've heard about nursing since the third meeting we've been at to talk about this is that maybe there's not a real shortage right now, but there's going to be a big shortage in the future, and that one of the most limiting factors is not the number of students, because we're turning away thousands of nursing students every year from our programs, but the limiting factor to get more nursing in the future is clinical sites. You said did I sum that up right? And faculty, of course, faculty, which come from your site. So you said 2,000 nursing students a year go through the Alina hospitals. With this product, which seems like a no-brainer, I mean, this just seems like y'all need to do it, but will you double the capacity? What are you going to do? I mean, is that what's going to happen?
There's absolutely no way we could double the capacity. As Linda pointed out, we don't have the nursing staff to take double, but it certainly can make us more efficient. Now we can look at different days of the week, different shifts. Traditionally, nursing students come on Tuesday, Wednesday, day shift. In a program, that's when they have their clinical time. As you can imagine, every unit is busy now, Tuesdays and Wednesday day shift with nursing students. So we can now look across the week. Can we look at different kinds of units that maybe traditionally didn't take nursing students but would offer a wonderful education experience?
So, Ms. Froelich, the answer to the question is that, yes, in fact, this does or can increase capacity.
Yes, but it will not
double, but it does increase capacity.
But it will.
Ask just a little twist to that? So the limiting factor then is not the space and so forth, but it's really the faculty, which is really your nursing staff at the hospital. And you need to... As that demand happens and you're short of nurses, you can't get them hired, that will probably be solved internally. Would that be a fair assumption?
To the faculty.
Ms. Froelich.
More complicated. In nursing education, traditional nursing education, you need nursing faculty with clinical groups that actually come to the hospital site with a group of nursing students so they can learn the skills of delivering nursing care. Those are traditionally your junior level nursing students. Then as they become senior students, they come individually and are assigned a preceptor that's a staff nurse or an employee on the unit. So then they're partnered with them. So we have a combination. So we still have a shortage of faculty because they need to come with those clinical groups. But we also need faculty to oversee all those precepted students that are going to be at a lot of different sites during one semester. So it's a difficult question to answer with just a simple answer.
Can I say something?
Ms. Balchuk.
One of the things with student max is, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. One of the things is it sets out in the calendar, like, Heather had said, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday is usually when clinicals happen or when students come. Well, now with the calendar, we're able to see who's coming, what school's coming, what days and times. So it'll show that, you know, maybe Thursday and Friday, we have more open space on different units. So that a different, say it was the U of M, I could say to them, all right, I know you have students on this unit from Monday and Tuesday, but here we have an opening Thursdays and Fridays somewhere else. So it does give them an opportunity to look at different times, a different schedule. It does create more space because what we have in the past is every hospital setting did something different, and we really couldn't get a handle. I couldn't get a handle on, you know, I do Southdale. I wouldn't know what Ridges is doing. I wouldn't know what the U of M is doing. But now we're able to see where the students are and where they're being placed. So we can kind of switch around where the clinicals happen and, you know, where are they. It does keep a good base for us.
Ms. Beast.
I'd like to add there's other features with this as well that we've worked out in these partnerships. When they've talked about needing more clinical staff, we have some arrangements with adjunct faculty, so our qualified employees that meet the education requirements could be in charge of that cohort group that comes out in an arrangement to help with some of the shortages. And that's what we've done in addition, you know, if we need to keep, and they know our sites really well. So there are some strategies underway to address that other issue.
I wonder, is there anybody from Minskew in the room?
I'm kind of with Minskew.
Ms. Beal, I'm trying to figure out, kind of off of Mr. Taubenheim's question, what percentage of our institutions, educational institutions, are utilizing this? And I was just kind of looking at the list, and I don't have a real good handle on that. So for educational institutions, I'm not sure what the downside would be here, and so I'm interested to know if there are some that are not in.
Anybody that is working with a clinical partner that we're working with has been invited and is in the partnership. We're very inclusive, not exclusive, because we're working with the real environment of where clinicals are needed and where they're provided. So it's not just Minskew and the U of M. It's also private colleges and proprietary colleges. I know that we have about 58% of the nursing schools in the entire state. I haven't broken that down by Minskew schools, but I can certainly do that.
So 58% of the educational institutions in Minnesota that are providing
nursing education
are participating. So I want to know what is prohibiting.
The only thing that's inhibiting it is there's a 0.75 person leading this, and we've already grown by more than 50% since March. So it's basically, we haven't advertised this. It's all been, people have been jumping on by word of mouth, and there's considerable training time to get new, such as Fairview Children's and Health East on board. So, and also, first we get the clinical site, and then we invite the education programs. So mainly it's probably that the clinical partners that we're working with just haven't been providing clinical sites with that education program. But as we expand, because I know Duluth is interested in us too, then we will also expand to other areas of the state.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. B.
I sit on the Health Forth Executive Alliance and then the HEAP Council as well. I'm the chair. And one of the things that is slowing down the spread of this is what Liz said with, you know, not having too many dedicated resources. But at the same time, this is a tool that we're using throughout the state, but Health Force is kind of sponsoring it. And I know on that board meeting, they're trying to figure out a way to sustain it. So I think when you're thinking of incentives, you might want to consider this, because if we had the right resources, it could be spread. And I think it does really help with efficiency and getting more people into clinical sites, but one person can't do it. And we want to spread it to other professions, and I know the board is talking about how do we figure out how to pay for this. I mean, you've gotten some grants, but it does really serve the University of Minnesota, Minskew, and the private colleges and universities.
Dr.
I just want to say, as a healthcare professional and educator, I'm inspired, and I just want to congratulate you.
Thank you very much.
Beautiful and an elegant solution. So I just want to thank you.
Ms. Beal, I would like to ask for some follow-up, if you could, on this handout that you provided us. On the very bottom, it talks about return on investment.
Mm-hmm.
It says, could realistically save Minnesota over $5 million per year in healthcare educator and provider resources.
How I came up with that number?
Well, what I'm really interested in is if there's a potential to make a case that this could save the state of Minnesota, or directly or indirectly through our public institutions. We are always looking for creative measures that can provide some assistance there. So if you could give that some thought and perhaps follow up with the chairs, that would
sure.
be appreciated. I would think that Minsky and the university would welcome those numbers and suggestions as well.
I would like to mention about that number is it's only nursing, so it doesn't have all the other direct care professionals. Also, it's only Minnesota, and our neighboring community, like La Crosse, they help educate a lot of Minnesota students through their facilities. So they're also our partners. I know South Dakota does too. And also, I didn't know how to put a number on that of everybody working together so that education programs have the capacity they need today and also built the foundation so we can plan for our expansions that we know we're going to need for tomorrow. And so this is just time.
Very good. That was enlightening. And sometimes it's nice to kind of hear a good story or good pilot.
Thank you.
That's producing some good results. Dr. Riggs.
I would just echo.
Sorry, Rice.
Yeah. I would just echo the comments about it. Really well thought out and well executed. I'm wondering if Ms. Beal would be interested in having her apply some of her talents to the medical issues of trying to coordinate all the different forms and different aspects of care, because this is the sort of thing that I think really makes for big problems throughout the healthcare system is all the different systems, different approaches, different approvals and stuff. And anything like this that can be applied throughout the system is really a wonderful thought.
Thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you very much for joining us today. And again, I'd like to thank Senator Erickson Ropes for bringing this to our attention. Before we conclude, I wanted to announce for your planning purposes, at our last meeting we entertained the possibility of us having an off-site meeting in the Rochester area. We will not be doing that. Our meetings will all be held here in St. Paul. So for your planning, that might be something that you want to note. But we appreciate your consideration of the idea. And I'm going to ask Representative Liebling to make a few final comments, particularly about this idea of incentives and what we can prepare and think about for our next meeting. Representative Liebling.
Okay. Well, thank you, Senator Lynch. And I just want to say I was really inspired by that, too. I mean, this is really, and also, Dr. Rice, I had kind of the same thought, how many things this could be applied to, or could it be? You know, just this idea of kind of how can we coordinate and use our full capacity and you know, whether we can build on this to try to help us expand capacity. I mean, it's really great. I think as we look at the charge of this committee and our need to sort of come up with something practicable that we can report on to the larger group and that can be actually helpful in moving us forward, I guess I really would like to tap the expertise of this committee. There's so much information and that we've been given that we there's a lot to digest here. I know each of you are really experts in your own areas, and I just think this has been, for me, it's been incredibly educational so far, even our few meetings, to have the interchange between all of you from your different areas of expertise and to hear some of what we've heard. But I would like all of you to look again at the charge that we have, which is really focused on the issue of incentives. It says evaluate the effectiveness of incentives that are currently available, and then to study alternative incentives. And I guess I would like to ask each of you to think about that in your own area of expertise, and maybe to come in with some thoughts on what particular couple of incentives you know of in your area that are working well, maybe some that haven't worked as you would like them to, and maybe some ideas that you have about what couple of incentives would be most useful in your own area. Because somehow we have to kind of start narrowing the funnel here, and I know you all are kind of different parts of the healthcare system. We're kind of like all touching the elephant in different places, right? And somehow we have to, you know, try to figure out how we can prioritize things. And so I guess, I don't know if anybody else, we haven't talked about that. I just kind of came up with that. So, you know, and if any of you have a different way or a suggestion about it, kind of how we can make our time together here more useful and actually come to a conclusion among all of us from our different areas, I would love to hear that. This is kind of mine off the top of my head from listening today and reading what we were given to read and thinking about this. We all have kind of a basic, you know, we sort of all, maybe we have different ideas of what the problem is, but we've been given some common data here, at least, you know, those of us who've attended all the meetings or read the materials that have been given to us. So how can we kind of come together around what a report would look like and, you know, what suggestions we can make as a group going forward? Any comment? Dr. Beer?
Do we have agreement on the definition of shortage yet? Do we agree there is or isn't a shortage in two or three fields or just one? Because if we're going to make prioritized incentives, I think we should be able to answer that question. Mm-hmm. A hypothesis is we're trying to leverage as much of the interdisciplinary practice experience and productivity as we can into the future. And I'm in other places where we're trying to do everything we can on interdisciplinary education / practice and point of service training, which I think we heard about just right now. So I would just wonder, could if we just assume for the moment that in the near term there may not be, in fact, a shortage of certain fields, that doesn't mean we are yet accepting that we have proper productivity of the combination of several professionals to yield the better outcome for patients. Mm-hmm. So even if we have, let's say, a surplus of nursing or pharmacy right now, I don't know that we do, but if we did, that still doesn't mean with all of us here, we still know how to work together well enough to get a better outcome for the public. And so to me, we could therefore tolerate not having an ever solid answer on what workforce shortage does or doesn't exist. We still don't know how to work together well enough and how to teach it well enough to really maximize the benefit to the public. And to me, that's the fulcrum that we could all agree on, is the interdisciplinary both training and practice incentives.
Dr. Riggs.
That was going to be my comment, that really what's new from 2008-09 is the healthcare home legislation and the ACO, and so maybe the framework of the report could be how the workforce issues need to be incentivized differently in that context.
Mr. Taubenheim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I think about incentives, and I like to get my head around this by asking, what are the barriers to more workers in healthcare in whatever field it might be? And the question is our goal to just create more jobs or more workers, or I mean, we've talked a lot about identifying how many are we going to need? What's the need going to be in the future? So I made the comment with the nursing is we'll just make the assumption that we're going to need a whole bunch of them that we can't produce. We don't know that's going to happen. And, of course, we talk a lot about care model and the healthcare home, whatever it might be, that could drive that. And, of course, I work with the physician side, and my friend Dr. Baird, we can talk about primary care physicians and the need for that. I think that, you know, at some point we would probably like to talk a little bit about the physician workforce issues a little bit more with this group. But as I think about, you know, PAs, nurse practitioners, pharmacists, other caregivers in them working with the primary care physicians, is that's, you know, we're dealing with care model, and what will drive that is the market. Whether we think that the care should be provided by primary care physicians or physician extenders, the market will drive that if they're not there. And so as I think about incentives, I think about barriers. And so we talk a lot about what specialty positions are out there. And we have a pretty limited number of physician slots that we can educate or that we can afford to have in the Twin Cities or in any community, really. And what we see is we can measure it a little bit by, you know, how many applicants, medical school applicants, are applying for surgical residency versus family medicine residency, and what's driving that, and how can we get more incentive then. And so there's probably a bit of that we should probably provide directly to you in terms of what we see around the medical physician in that regard. So I encourage, I guess, to think about it as a what is the barrier, as well as what can we do to remove that barrier.
Dr. Riggs. I'm sorry, Dr. Rice. Sorry.
We'll see Rice and Riggs next.
I don't even hear well enough to notice. Just kind of echoing a little bit on Dr. Baird's comments and kind of in light of my comments to Ms. Beal, that actually all three, I guess, but the shortage issue, I think, exists and will be an issue, especially in primary care. And as a physician primary care, that's important. But also, I think thinking more broadly, other than just incentives to get more workforce out there, which is good, I think this concept of removing obstacles, streamlining things, making for better efficiencies is a big aspect too. So,
I'm going to make a suggestion off of Representative Liebling's request that you come forward with some ideas from your particular areas. Tasha, maybe you can remind us of when our next meeting is. October 12th. It would be very helpful to the chairs if you would, via email, send us some thoughts ahead of time. So in that way, we will be able to sort of sort through this. And if we need additional materials or additional testimony or additional background, that we can pull that together. I don't have a calendar in front of me, but sometime before, if we're meeting on October 12th, sometime before October 11th would be good. Please don't wait until the morning of the 12th. But if you could give that some thought, does that seem reasonable? I think it doesn't. You don't have to necessarily, you know, lay out your full-scale plan, but if you can give us some thoughts, that enables us to get the expertise gathered that we might find helpful in.
Key points and suggestions.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, shift that Ms. to Olson. Tasha, then?
Okay. Why don't you send those to Representative Liebling and myself via email? That would be very helpful. And we can sort through that.
Or might be, if it would be possible, maybe for you guys, to whoever wants it back, to send us an email that we can respond to. That would probably make sure it gets to the right place.
Excellent.
Absolutely. Okay. Tasha will take care of that. Mm-hmm. That's great. Good suggestion. Representative Lee.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I want to revisit just really briefly this issue about, you know, defining workforce, defining shortage. And I think that's a really important issue. And I think we kind of, in a previous meeting, we sort of, because I've been sort of struggling with this, how are we going to come up with something that's meaningful? And the whole idea of, you know, do we need people, numbers of people that we're counting, numbers of jobs, are we counting, are we saying we need so much service? I mean, I think it's clear to everybody that we've got an aging population, we have more disabled people, you know, the workforce, the number of young people that are going to be in the workforce is going to be less. I mean, we know the services are going to be needed. So I guess I'm still struggling with, I think it's a very good point, Dr. Baird. How do we define it? What do we agree is the issue that we need to attack? And when I read the charge, I'm sort of trying to respond to the charge they gave us, even right. though I agree it's rather narrow. You know, I mean, when I look at this, and it really is talking about, you know, getting people there, the right people trained and retained, you know. But it doesn't really talk about, you know, what the service need is. So, I mean, maybe we have to agree to rewrite our charge, you know. But if we're going to do that, we probably need to agree to do that explicitly so that we know what our product is going to be, Dr. Baird.
Madam Chair, a thought I have is that if we're around, as you stated, a lot of people with expertise, it's hard to describe some things. But I think the gap is not just in a field like nursing or pharmacy or advanced practice nursing. It's in the task of integrating all those potential care delivery people to work together to improve the health of a population. And we have a model that we're nationally going to test. We don't know if it'll work, this healthcare home. If we were to focus this like a vision of how to give incentives to work in that kind of a team, they're not laying off nurses or others at the team level on ambulatory primary care things. They may be doing it at hospitals and other places, but they're not doing that for pharmacists and nurses or dentists right at the fulcrum of that. And if we use the healthcare home as a framework and how to get those integrated health professionals to function more effectively, frankly, a decade later to be needed less, that's the goal. And I don't think we have a solution to that, but if we said that's where we want to provide the incentives, it isn't this big then. It's right there. And yet we still need neurosurgical teams, everybody else. There's no question. You know, they're showing up there. That's where the money is. We don't need incentives for that. We need it over here where they're trying to not end up in the neurosurgical unit.
This,
again, Representative Lee.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I'd like to, I mean, that has a lot of appeal, and it would be if we could focus our efforts there, I think that would be very helpful. What do other people think? I mean, is that something we can kind of agree on that we could focus toward?
Working around that,
that
healthcare
concept
home
as a way to
model.
Talk about our incentives.
That is the direction mm-hmm. that we are in. Mm-hmm. And as sitting on the Health Policy Committee, that would be very helpful. Mm-hmm. It would be very helpful. And I think that we would also, once again, you know, I'm always continue to be very proud and amazed as I am in conversations with colleagues from across the country. We are so well positioned going into this, and so suggesting that kind of a focus would just project us that much further.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I'm in.
Yeah.
Great. Madam Chair, if I could so when you send us your suggestions and your thinking about in your own area, maybe if we could kind of keep that in mind, that we're talking about incentives toward healthcare homes and collaborative practice, that would be really helpful. And then we'll move ahead from there. And thank you all very much. I think it's been a very helpful meeting.
Tasha will follow up with an email to everyone. She will, she'll send out the charge to you. She will summarize what we're asking for, and I'm going to ask her to also suggest a deadline so that we have ample opportunity to work with Mr. Giel and others to, so we have what we need at our next meeting. With that, thank you, everyone, for coming today. Once again, we really appreciate it, and I know that the larger Healthcare Access Commission is very much anxious to hear from us and is watching the work that we do. So thanks for your help. The meeting is adjourned.
Great. No.
I love it. It was such a beautiful
little thing. Yeah. Told me to tell you
a story. He finally figured out that you were.
I know. What is happening?